We were on vacation in the lovely Ozarks. We were in Eureka Springs, which is just on the border of Missouri and Arkansas. And it was really nice. We actually had sort of a treehouse, kind of a cabin kind of a thing. I say treehouse, but it's actually bigger. It was a little bit bigger than our first apartment. So, you know, it wasn't that bad. And I'm going to take my jacket off because it's warm. It was really beautiful. All the trees and the flowers were in bloom. Of course, you know, the mountains up there are full of beautiful red buds and dogwoods and pollen. Lots of pollen. So I was hoping to return to you less, with fewer inflamed sinuses than I left you. And that did not happen, but that's okay. We're gonna muddle through, and hopefully I won't do anything ridiculous with biblical chronology this week. Go and take your Bibles, turn them to the book of Isaiah, chapter 5. Book of Isaiah, chapter 5. We are, of course, continuing our study through the book of Isaiah. And we're actually going to start out this morning by introducing to you an idea, which I'm not going to give you the payoff for until next week. So you have to come back next week.
Yeah, I know.
C.S. Lewis, writing God in the Dock, talks about thick and clear religions. Has anybody heard this before, thick and clear religions? So the idea is, here's what he says. He says, we may reverently divide religions, as we do suits, into thick and clear. By thick, I mean those which have orgies and ecstasies and mysteries and local attachments. Africa is full of thick religions. And also, if you want to think of other thick religions, you can maybe think of some of the fertility cults in biblical times, things like that. By clear, I mean those which are philosophical, ethical, and universalizing. Stoicism, Buddhism, the ethical church, those are all clear religions. Now, if there is a true religion, it must be both thick and clear. For the true God must have made both the child and the man, both the savage and the citizen, both the head and the belly. And the only two religions that fulfill this condition are Hinduism and Christianity. But Hinduism fulfills it imperfectly. The clear religion of the Brahmin hermit in the jungle and the thick religion of the neighboring temple go on side by side. The Brahmin hermit doesn't bother about the temple prostitution, nor the worshiper in the temple about the hermit's metaphysics. But Christianity really breaks down the middle wall of the partition. It takes a convert from Central Africa and tells him to obey an enlightened universalist ethic. It takes a 20th century academic prig like me, or 21st century academic prig like me, and tells him to obey an enlightened universe, and tells me to go fasting to a mystery to drink the blood of the Lord. The savage convert has to be clear. I have to be thick. That is how one knows one has come to the real religion. And that's just an excerpt from a much longer and much more involved essay. So I don't want to, my goal this morning is not to overgeneralize or oversimplify such a difficult subject, because I'm not actually going to be, well, I'm going to be talking a little bit about thick and clear religions this morning, but my focus is not to so much talk about thick and clear religions this morning as to introduce this vocabulary of thick and clear, actually as a way of us talking about our sin. I want to sort of propose to you this morning that there are thick sins and clear sins, all right? There are sins which are sins of the flesh and the body and the physical appetites. Those are the thick sins. Just like there are thick religions with the mystery cults and the. Tirza, you need to go sit down now. We're having church. Go sit down. I understand, but you need to do that after church. Go sit down. She tells me they're trying to kill some monsters. I don't know where she got that from.
I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Granny. Sophie is getting allergy medication for Tirza, who got a bunch of ant bites yesterday, and it's very itchy. So, anyway, that's where her mother is. Yes. So there are thick religions and thick sins, and these are things that are, they're, you know, Lewis signifies them by the belly, but it's talking about our physical appetites. And those are the main kinds of sins we're going to be talking about today. Next week, though, we're going to talk about some of the clear sins. These are the sins of the intellect, sins of the spirit. We could almost call them spiritual sins. And the And these are things like pride, envy, self-will, self-wisdom, self-satisfaction, self-righteousness. These are all clear sins. And some people are more prone, I think, to one kind of sin or the other. It's not to say you can't have both. It's not to say if you don't have one, you don't have any of them. And it's not to say that if you have one, that you're free from the other kind. But I think a lot of people tend to sort of gravitate towards one kind of sin or the other. The early church fathers and the doctors of the Middle Ages, people like Aquinas and on into the Reformation, with people like Calvin, taught that since man's spiritual nature is of a higher order than his emotional soul or his animal nature, his physical body, that a sin of the spiritual nature was of a more severe order because the fall is greater. So, you know, if you've got something in you that's of a higher order, something in you that is capable of relating to God and is free from, or should be free from, the weight of the flesh, when you sin with your spirit, they taught that that sin is of a higher order, that it does more damage to your soul than a sin of the physical body. Now, and just as an example of this, our first parents sinned, Adam and Eve sinned, not just because they were trying to satisfy a physical desire for pleasing food. You know, it sort of started out like that with Eve seeing that the apple was pleasant and that it looked like it was going to be good to eat. But their final sin, the thing that really resulted in the fall of men, was because they were lusting after the wisdom and the power which the serpent promised them. You will be like God. Now, in today's passage, we're going to see both thick and clear sin dealt with. And I have a suspicion we'll only get to the thick part of it today. Both have led Judah on to judgment, and Isaiah is going to preach against both. So it's not Isaiah's intention that anyone should get a pass just because their sin was less severe than another. So please don't walk away with that idea this morning. That's not how this works. But he does treat them differently, and I think that in looking at Judah's sin, we can learn some important things about the way that sin manifests in our own lives. And so what I want to encourage you to do this morning, and next week as well, because it's going to be a two-parter, is to look for yourself and look for your sin in Isaiah's condemnation of Judah. And that's maybe not the way that we like to look for ourselves in the Bible, but especially as we're reading through some of these passages which are really about judgment, and they're about dealing with sin, about being serious about sin, I think that's what we're supposed to do with them. So look for yourself. Look for your sin. But we're going to start out this morning. I need a volunteer to read verses 1 through 7. Because we're going to start out this morning with a parable. Before we get into the judgment, we're going to start out with a parable. So somebody want to read verses 1 through 7 for me. All right, go ahead.
Oh, right.
Yep.
I'm still reading.
Oh.
Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vines. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and also hewed out a wine vat in it. He then expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only withered, worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more has there to do for my vineyard than I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So, let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. I will lay waste. It will not be pruned or hewed, but briars and thorns will come up. And I also charge the clouds to rain, no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah its delightful plant. Thus he will look for justice, but behold, bloodshed for righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress.
Thank you. All right, so Isaiah begins this section. Remember, chapters 2 to 5, so chapter 1, this is a recap, chapter 1 was the overview of Isaiah's entire ministry. So it's like an overview of his whole message. It's a prologue. Chapters 2 to 5 are sort of his very first message, sort of his very first complete sermon. And that's where we've been for the last several weeks. And so Isaiah begins this section of his first message with the parable, or the allegory, of the vineyard. And this section is commonly regarded as one of the most beautiful examples of poetry in Isaiah. And I weep for us this morning that none of us are any good at Hebrew, because, at least I'm not, because there's a lot going on here poetically that we just have to miss in English. It's not because English is a poor language than Hebrew, but it's because it was written in Hebrew, and Isaiah is doing a lot of things in Hebrew that you just that are very difficult to translate. There's a lot of assonance in this, which is a little like rhyme. It's where two words sound very similar, they have a very similar sound quality to them. They don't necessarily rhyme consonantally like we do rhyming in English, but they're assonant. There's a lot of assonance in these, especially in the first three verses. There's also a lot of native idiom that does some really neat things, does some things called paronomesia, which is a pun, which I'll call that out when we get to it, because that one's pretty easy to explain. So while, of course, we can translate some of the bare meaning as well as the parallelism, remember, parallelism is the main feature of Hebrew poetry, and it fortunately does translate quite well, but there's a lot other going on here. There's some really artful things that Isaiah does here that we just have to miss. I'll point out one or two of them as we go along, but I'm not going to spend too much time on them because it would just take too long to explain. I don't want to bog down the lesson. I don't want to obscure the text. But he starts out with the Song of the Beloved. So he says, I will sing, or let me sing a song for my beloved. Now, who is I here? What's that? No, the I is Isaiah. Yeah, no, it's okay. I ask because it's sort of genuinely confusing because the perspective of the text changes three verses in. So in verses 1 to 2, it's Isaiah singing about God, and then in verse 3, God picks up the narration. So it is tricky, and that's why I asked, okay? So if Isaiah is the singer, who is the beloved? Right, that's God. There we go. Okay, good job. Process of elimination. And when he says, I'm going to sing a song of my beloved, I think you're reading the King James. Was that the King James? Yeah, it said, well, beloved, in the King James. This is a verse which has been variously translated. I think in the Vulgate, it's actually translated uncle. And in Martin Luther's translation of the Bible into German, he actually translates it as uncle as well. And there are a few more modern translations which translate it friend or close friend or best friend. The idea is that this beloved is someone who is very close to the singer, somebody about whom they care very much, about, you know, somebody for whom they share their pain. I think the reason for the uncle translation is that the relationship between nephew and mother's brother, so specifically your maternal uncle, used to be a much more significant relationship in past cultures than it is in ours. Like, we don't really make a big deal out of it beyond the fact that that person is your uncle. But in the Middle Ages, it was a typical practice for a young man, especially of a good family, to go and actually foster for several years with his mother's brother. And that was just sort of a, like, that tie back to your mother's family. And it was a really important relationship. I think it's hard for us to understand how important that relationship was. So I think that's why the Vulgate and why Martin Luther translated this word that way. So the idea is that it's somebody that's very close to you, somebody who is almost your patron, somebody who you feel very strongly about. And the picture that we're given here in this passage, which we just read, is that of a husbandman who makes a vineyard for the processing of wine. So he goes to till the earth, and it says he digs it out, he removes all of the stones. And this is no easy task in Palestine. There's a bit of Arab folklore about Palestine, which I've always liked. They say that when, you know, it's just sort of, it's a fun thing, I guess they say. But when God was making the world, he sent an angel into the world with a bag of all of the stones for the world, the stones that are supposed to be distributed all over the world. And as the angel is flying over Palestine, the bag gets a tear, and half of the stones fall out onto Palestine. And so the joke is that half of all the stones that are supposed to be distributed out throughout the entire planet are there in Palestine. The rest of them are in West Texas, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, well, you say that, but I was out, and this isn't even West Texas, I was out in Mineral Wells, and if you go past Mineral Wells, you get to Weatherford, thank you. I was out, this is back in my sign putter upper days, I was out in Mineral Wells building a sign, and I had to, you know, drive these holes for the post of the sign down, and they had to be like 3-foot holes. There is not a single inch of soil in Weatherford, Texas. It is all shale. It was terrible. It was a brutally hot day that day too. It's very firmly lodged in my memory. So he digs out all of the stones, and he sets up a vineyard. And in fact, he goes on. He built a watchtower to watch over the vineyard to keep thieves and animals from coming in and eating the fruit. And he built a press and a wine vat in the midst of it for the processing of it. And so, and you have to, the wine press and the wine vat, there are, the way they would make these is they would actually find a very large stone, like a quarry level, you know, piece of stone. We actually hiked through a quarry this last week. It was really, really cool. But they would actually quarry out a large section of rock, and they would have to carve it out of a single piece of stone, and there would actually be two places. There would be one place where you did the trapping of the grapes, right? And then there was sort of a long slant of stone down to a basin, also of stone, where all of the grape juice would drain for collection in the back there. And so this vineyard, this husbandman, has gone to an enormous amount of work to make a vineyard where good fruit will grow. He intends to watch over it. He intends to bear fruit. And I think without doing a whole lot of strain to the text here, we can see a similarity between the preparations that the husbandman made for his vineyard and the things that God did, that Jehovah did for Israel. He dug out the stones of the nations that were in the promised land before Israel. He drove them out before them. He gave them victory so that they would be able to bear fruit there in the land which God had promised to Abraham. And what happens? He says, I looked for it to yield grapes. Why did it yield wild grapes? So in verses 3 to 4, Isaiah's role as singer ends, and the husbandman, Jehovah, God, now speaks directly. The husbandman had looked for his vineyard to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes instead. These are acrid, sour fruits. There's a kind of wild grape growing in the Middle East today, and I don't know if it was there in Isaiah's time, but I sort of imagined that it was. And they're called wolf grapes, and they're extreme. They look like normal grapes. They're externally similar, but the fruit is extremely bitter and acrid. It's not pleasant to eat. And that is what the husbandman is saying here. He's saying, I looked for it to yield grapes, and yet it has grown up. You know, I've planted it, I've dug it, I've cultivated it, I've fertilized it, I've done all these things, and I was expecting grapes, and what I got were wild grapes. And he calls upon Judah. He says, now I will tell you what I will do, verse 4, he says, what more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? He's calling upon Judah to judge. And Judah's the guilty party here. But he's calling upon them. He's saying, tell me, what else could I have done for the vineyard? And of course, by extension, what more could I have done for you? Right. What is there that I drove out your enemies. I gave you the law. I've given you judges. I've given you David. I've given you prophets. What more was there that I could do? And he calls upon them to sort of judge themselves. And it reminds me of the way that Nathan, when he's telling David the story about this man who stole the sheep from the other man, and David gets really angry and passes judgment upon himself. That's kind of what is happening here. We're getting a story, we're getting a parable to help give the people of Judah some perspective. And so then in verses 5 through 6, we get the beloved's destruction of the vineyard. He says he's going to remove the hedge. He's going to break, I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. He removes the hedge, in order to allow it to be grazed over by wild animals. He no longer prunes it or weeds it. And of course, I think the wild animals here, these are the nations that are going to come in and judge it. And ever since this, ever since the Babylonian captivity, ever since then, Palestine has been a place where the wild animals, where all the nations of the world come to graze and come to trample down God's chosen people. And that still has not been changed. That still has not been rectified. So he removes the hedge in order to allow it to be grazed over. He no longer prunes it or weeds it. And he no longer sends rain. And by the time you get to the point where, you know, I'm not sending rain anymore, I think it should be pretty evident that we're not dealing with an ordinary gardener. We haven't gotten the significatio is the Latin word for it, but we haven't gotten the explanation of the parable yet. We're about to, but we haven't gotten it yet. But already inside the parable, the gardener, the husbandman, says, I will no longer send rain. Well, obviously, when you get to the point where you can send the rain, you're beyond just being an ordinary gardener. Now, I am a gardener. I'm not a very good one, but I'm a very determined one. Last year, we had too much rain last year, and it washed out a bunch of my fruit trees and killed a bunch of our vegetables, and it was just really pretty bad. So this year, we got out there, and we moved the vegetable gardens to somewhere where they would have more sun and better drainage, and I've got to do something about all the dead fruit trees I've got. But we also planted a huge flower bed the weekend before we went on vacation, and put that in the front, and it's going to be ferns and elephant ears and I don't know what else. Whatever Sophie said to plant, I planted. I'm just the muscle. I just dig the holes. So, but I can't send the rain. Now, I can choose to water things, right? I can go out and choose to water, and if I don't, then the plants will very quickly die. But I can't send the rain. And this is what the gardener is saying. He said, I'm not going to send the rain anymore. And here's the thing about the beloved, about the husbandman. He is saying, I would rather the vineyard be incapable of bearing any fruit at all than that it bear wild grapes. And if you think about that, that's a pretty strong statement. Now in verse 7, we get the significatio, we get the explanation. Israel and Judah are the vineyard, Jehovah is the husbandman. Now, that seems pretty obvious to us now because we are here in this class doing this. But I think, you know, I think it was probably also obvious to Isaiah's hearers that they probably knew where this was going. And he says, I was expecting grapes, but what I got was wild grapes. And then he says, I was expecting, and then he says, here are the grapes I was expecting, and here are the wild grapes I got. And so he says, I was expecting justice, instead I got bloodshed. I was expecting righteousness, instead I got an outcry. An outcry it means the outcry of one who has been wronged. So I was expecting righteousness, instead I've got people who have been wronged and who are crying out for justice. Now, there are a lot of words in these first seven verses that are assonant. In other words, they sound like each other. This is the strongest example of it, and what Isaiah is doing is he's making a pun in Hebrew. He's making a set of very elaborate puns. And the fancy literary criticism term for puns is paronomasia, but it just means a pun. It just means a pun. It's a bit of wordplay that suggests two or more meanings. So if I say John the Baptist was the first Baptist preacher to ever lose his head over dancing, that is a pun. Right? Because he, you know, the lose his head can mean two different things, and over dancing can mean a couple of different things. So it's a bit of wordplay that signifies two or more meanings. That's the pun. And I just ruined puns for you by explaining them. Okay. That's the other thing. If you have to explain it, it's not a good pun. Often I have to explain my puns because Sophie's not laughing. And then she'll turn to me and she'll say, no, I got it. No, I got it. So, I got a good one. Oh, yeah, that's what it was, the husky. neighbor was walking their dogs, and they have two huskies and a golden retriever. She said, look at all those pretty dogs. I said, well, a couple of them look a little overweight. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, they're kind of husky. And, unlike anything that I have just said, Isaiah is doing two very clever puns. He says, I was expecting justice in Hebrew, that's mishpat, but you gave me bloodshed, mishpah. I was expecting mishpat, you gave me mishpah. I was expecting righteousness. I've puzzled over this one for a week, you guys. Hebrew's a lot easier when I don't have to do it out loud. And anyway, I was expecting righteousness, tzedakah, but you gave me an outcry, tzaka. So he's making two puns. And so bloodshed and justice, righteousness and outcry, they sound similar in Hebrew, like really close, almost the same word. So here is what I think he is suggesting. And this is one example. There are many examples. In the first verse alone, there are about seven different assonances that do this, like just in the first verse. It's really well-written poetry. There's also a lot of interesting examples of chiasmus, which is where you have a pattern that it's like a... You guys know what a palindrome is, right? A palindrome is a word which is spelled the same way forward and backward. Well, chiasmus is like a palindrome, but instead of doing it with letters, you do it with words. And in Hebrew, or sometimes with concepts, And basically that the words or the concepts are the same forward as they are backwards. And this whole section is just full of these, you know, chiasms in Hebrew. And you can actually see the structure of those in English as well. And I'm not going to get into them this morning because, again, we would get lost. But it's really cool. Like, I want you guys to understand, just because the Bible is true doesn't mean it's not well written. Right. It's really well done. But what I think that Isaiah is doing, he's not just being a clever poet. What I think he's suggesting, so bloodshed sounds like justice. Outcry sounds like righteousness. What I think he's suggesting is that I looked to get grapes, but what I got was wild grapes. That these things are externally similar. That if you hear the word justice and you hear the word bloodshed, they sound the same, but they mean something completely different. That if you look at grapes and wild grapes, they look the same, but the inside contents of the fruit are something completely different. Israel, remember back to chapter 1 and chapter 2, where Isaiah says, yeah, you're worshiping at the temple, but I don't want your sacrifices. I don't want your worship because you're doing it out of a heart that is rotten to the core. Israel externally looks obedient. They look good. They are still worshiping at the temple. They are still doing the sacrifices at the temple. They will abandon those things later on in Judah's history, but not yet. That hasn't happened yet. But all of this was only an outward show, and it is one which was not matched by what was inside their hearts. And so in this very clever bit of poetry, this bit of punning Isaiah is doing, I think there's a very strong condemnation of where Judah was at the time, and where some of us may be at today. That we look good on the outside. We're going through the actions on the outside. But inside, our hearts are full not of righteousness and justice, but of injustice and bloodshed and bitterness and hatred for our fellow believers. Now, there's one further note that I want to hit before we proceed further in the text. And that is that this allegorical symbolism of Israel or Judah as the vineyard and God as the owner or the husbandman of the vineyard, this is an imagery which is used quite often by our Lord. He gives, there's at least one parable of the vineyard or the vine in every single one of the Gospels, and there are two in Matthew, and I think two in Luke as well. And all of those allegories, all of those parables that Jesus gives of the vineyard have their roots, metaphorically and literally, I suppose, in this chapter. So when we read the parables of the vineyard in you know, Mark, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. So when you get things like the man who goes out to hire laborers for his vineyard, and he hires some in the morning, some in the middle of the day, and some an hour before closing time, and he pays them all the same at the end of the day. We should be reading that, not just by itself, not just isolated, but we need to read it in the context of Isaiah chapter 5. When we read the parable of the man who owned the vineyard, and he went away for a while, and he would send servants, and the people who ran the vineyard were unfaithful stewards, and they killed the servants that he sent, and or beat them, and finally he sent his own son, and they killed his son. We should be reading that parable in the context of Isaiah chapter 5. There is a conversation which is happening that everything that Isaiah says here in Isaiah chapter 5, Jesus is in some sense responding to when he gives his parables of the vineyard. And we need to be really attentive to that. And if we had more time, I would love to look at each of those parables individually and see what light does Isaiah chapter 5 shed on them. But those would each be a lesson by themselves. So I will save that for the next time that Dad and Grandpa are both out on the same week. And we'll do that in the Sunday morning service, where I have unlimited time. So we'll save that. But if you want a project and you want to do something in your Bible study this week, maybe go home, look at Matthew chapter 20, Matthew chapter 21, Mark chapter 12, Luke chapter 20, and John chapter 15. Look at the parables of the vineyard in these passages, and if you want those again, I can give them to you after the class. Look at the parables of the vineyards in these passages and see how does knowing Isaiah chapter 5 is related to them? How does it maybe change or inform the way that you read them? So Isaiah's message now turns from the allegorical to the actual. And this next section is broken up into six smaller subsections. We're not going to get through all of them today. But each of them begins with a woe. And in a response to each of these woes, there is a therefore. There are actually three therefore clauses, but two of them are part of the same clause. So essentially, we're going to get two therefore sections, 13 and 14, and then verse 24. So there are six groups, six kinds of people, which Isaiah is pronouncing woe upon. And then of those six groups, he's going to break them down into two smaller groups with a specific judgment for each one of them. Or two larger groups for a specific judgment for each one of them. So there's a set of two, and then there's a set of four, and each set has its own judgment associated with it. We're going to take the first set, the set of two, this morning. And this is where we get into those thick sins that we talked about in the introduction. So, reading. Verses 8 through 12. Somebody want to get that? Faith? And then verses 13 through 17. Somebody else want to get that one? Not all at once. All right, go ahead. All right, so Faith, start us out.
Therefore, my people go into exile for lack of knowledge. Their honored men go hungry, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure, and the nobility of Jerusalem and the multitude will go down. The revelers and he who exalts in their man is humbled, and each one is brought low, and the eyes of the haughty are brought low. For the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. Then shall the lambs graze in the pasture, and no man shall eat among the ruins of the earth.
Okay. So the first class of people on whom the woes are to fall it's a woe to a covetous people. These are people whom Isaiah describes as joining house to house and adding field to field. In other words, what they're doing is they're wealthy landowners. They are people who are trying to buy up all of the property they can until their houses and their properties literally touch each other. That's the imagery that's given. And the implication, I think, and maybe it's hyperbole and maybe it's not, seems to be that this is not just a normal acquisition of property. God doesn't actually have a problem with people acquiring property. One of the ways that we're told we can make money in the Bible is to buy, sell, and get gain. That's not by itself a bad thing. But this is not just a normal acquisition of property. This is wanton and unjust acquisition on the part of the wealthy. This is the sin of avarice. John Chrysostom said that covetous men, if they could, would willingly take the son from the poor. There are some people who are just not satisfied with what they've been given. They're not satisfied with what they have because it's not just about them having it. It's about you not having it. And some of us, we're not covetous about our, perhaps our properties or our vineyards, but we are maybe covetous about our relationships. And it's not really so much that, you know, that there are people, and maybe you've known some of these people, it's not so much that they don't want you, it's not so much that they want you to be friends with them as they don't want you to be friends with someone else. And they dominate that relationship, and they try to monopolize that friendship. It's covetousness. It's a desire. If I have it, that means that somebody else doesn't. It's avarice. Now, Crassus, Marcus Licinius Crassus, probably one of the wealthiest men, maybe the wealthiest person who's ever lived, depending on your estimation of how wealthy he actually was. And there's a couple of records. Plutarch gives one sum, which comes out to about $9 billion. Pliny the Elder gives a much larger amount. But it's either way, he's one of the wealthiest people who has ever lived in history. Crassus made his money primarily, the way that he became so wealthy, he did make a little through the sale of what people at the time would have considered to be legitimate business through, mercantile efforts, transporting goods from one city to another, selling slaves, things like that. But the main way that Crassus made his fortune is that he tended to specialize in deals. Ancient Rome was built almost entirely out of wood, and this is true until Augustus, who says, "I found Rome a city of wood, and I have left it a city of marble." So he built a lot of those really nice buildings, and some of the emperors after him, Trajan and so forth, they built a lot of that stone structure architecture, which we can still see in Rome today. But in Crassus's time, Rome was mostly almost entirely built out of wood. And these are buildings which are built very close together with low, comparatively by modern standards, very low standards of sanitation or fire safety. And these are wooden buildings built close together, and they catch on fire quite easily, and they caught on fire pretty frequently. And so when a building in Rome would catch on fire, Rome had no fire brigade. So it was up to individuals to try to put out the fires. And people in Rome lived in these very large and very crowded, essentially tenement buildings. They were all very, very close together in these very crowded neighborhoods. It was one of the most densely populated cities in the ancient world. So when a building caught on fire, Crassus would show up with a fire brigade of 200 slaves. And these slaves were specifically trained. Crassus had hand-selected them for their knowledge of architecture and how to put out fires. And the Roman way of putting out a fire is you start pulling down the structure that is on fire so the fire doesn't spread to anything else. It's more mitigation than control. Crassus would show up with a crew, and he'd say, "Hi, I see your building is on fire. How much would you like to sell it for?" And if they said, "I'm not selling you my building," he said, "Okay, we'll just stand here and watch it burn." And then after about 10 minutes of burning, he'd make you another offer about half as low, you know, as the last offer. Until eventually he said, "Well, I guess I'm losing the property to fire anyway, so sure, you can have it for 20 sesterces," or whatever ridiculous, grossly under what the fair market value of the property would be. As soon as Crassus brought it, he would send the slaves in. The slaves would put out the fire. And then the next day, Crassus would have a new cheap tenement building built on the same spot because he's got an army of slaves with nothing else to do, and he doesn't care how good the quality is because, you know, if you don't like it, what are you going to do? I'm Crassus. Crassus was kind of an awful person. He died when he lost a battle with the Parthians, and the Parthians poured molten gold down his throat and then cut off his head. So, you know, there's something poetically ironic about that. And some historians actually... thank you for bringing your kids to my class, by the way. Some historians actually sort of doubt whether or not the whole poured gold down his throat thing really happened, or is that just poetic, you know, afterwards? I don't care. I like it. It saves. Crassus was one of these people who literally wanted to put building next to building, and by the time he died, he's one of the wealthiest men in all of Rome. The other thing he would do is he'd go around buying people's debts. He'd go around buying... The way that you executed somebody in ancient Rome was that you proscribed them, which basically means that the state puts out a bounty on their head and says, if you kill this person and bring them in, you'll get this much money. And so Crassus had a little proscription business. And so whenever somebody was proscribed, he had an army of gladiators that would go out and find the person and kill them, and Crassus would collect the bounty. You can do a lot with slaves that you don't have to pay. Crassus is an extreme example of this, right? Part of the sinful desire, of course, is to lay field next to field. And this is a violation of the spirit of the year of Jubilee. So in Jewish culture, you have this thing. Every 50 years, every seven sabbatical years, in other words, every 50 years, you have the year of Jubilee. And the idea of the year of Jubilee is that upon the year of Jubilee, all the slaves are freed. Unless they have purposely made themselves a slave to you for life, all the slaves are freed. All of the prop, and in this culture, slavery is mainly a way of working off debt. So basically what it means is that on the year of Jubilee, debts are forgiven, and any property which was sold outside of the family to which it originally belonged by allotment when Israel settled the promised land was returned to the family. Because what God wanted was for each family, each tribe, to have their allotment of land which he gave them. And that would always be an inheritance for that family, and that it would never be lost. And so that's the spirit of the year of Jubilee. And the remarkable thing is that there are only one or two instances recorded in the entire Bible where Israel actually kept the law and celebrated the Jubilee. And this is one of the most often broken laws in Scripture, and it's one of the ones for which... You know, one of the reasons that the Israelites go into captivity for 70 years is because they missed 70 Jubilees. They missed 70 sabbatical years when the land should have rested and the captives should have been freed and the debts should have been forgiven and the land been returned. And God says, you know what? You've missed 70 of these. So now we're going to give the land a chance to rest. I think that is in... Well, if I say, it'll be wrong. So I'll look that up later. But anyway, it's... This is a violation of the spirit of Jubilee. That's trying to acquire all of this land beyond what you have. Well, if people were doing things according to the law, you'd know that no matter how much land you acquired, you'd have to give it all back at the end of 50 years. And that was supposed to sort of keep people from greedily just grabbing up everything around them. And that is it's the spirit of Jubilee which kept Nabal in the northern kingdom from selling his vineyard to Ahab, and so Ahab has him killed for it. And so what's the punishment? The punishment for these people is that their many lands and properties are going to become desolate and in the coming judgment, and that they will only yield one-tenth of the expected harvest. All right, going to move quickly here. The second woe is a woe to a debauched people. The second class of people, which Isaiah condemns to woe, are those who pursue debauched pleasures in the forms of strong drink and music. Now, I do not believe, once again, that this is not a condemnation of wine, because if it was, it would also be a condemnation of music, and I certainly don't think that's what Isaiah is doing here. So, speaking to you, as a teetotaler, I will say, Psalm 104, God gave wine to gladden the heart of man. This is not a condemnation of wine. And it's not a condemnation of music. But these people are seeking after these goods out of proportion. they're seeking after them in the wrong way. Verse 11 says that they're rising early. Why? Not to rise early to seek after God. They're rising early so that they have more time to party. They're rising early so that they actually have more time to drink. This is a love out of order. They've taken something good, wine and music, which God has given both to gladden the heart of man, and they have made those their sole pursuit, their sole delight. Getting up early in the morning to start drinking seems like a bad, like, I don't get that. I mean, I don't get up, I have a hard time getting up early in the morning to begin with, and usually it is the drinking of coffee, which is the only saving grace that gets me anywhere on time. So, like, I don't understand this, getting up early so that you have more time to drink. But apparently, this is such a problem in the ancient world that there's several ancient moralist writers who write against it all the way into the classical age. You have writers like Juvenal and Cicero who are writing against the evils of getting up and starting your drinking early in the day. So apparently this is a problem for people. But notice also, it says that despite the fact that they surround themselves with music, they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hand. Now think about that. They are failing to enjoy things that God has given them in the proper way. Music, at its best, reaches at the beauty of the mind of God. It reaches at the order and the harmony of creation. But these people, despite the fact that they surround themselves with music, they cannot see the hand of God. They have become so obsessed with the gift that they have lost sight of the giver. Right? They've been so blinded by their abuse of the gift that they can no longer see in it the hand of the giver. And this is what happens when our loves, when our desires, when our appetites get out of proportion. The drunkard no longer takes joy in the wine. The porn addict no longer takes joy in sexual intimacy. The glutton loses all real joy in food because he's just trying to stuff himself. The pursuit of the endlessly self-medicating noise of pop music drowns out all the real joy that we're supposed to have in music, that it's supposed to refresh our soul, that it's supposed to quiet us, that it's supposed to lift our spirits, that it's supposed to enliven us. But most of the music that we have today is really just self-medicating. It's just noise. It's just to drown out thoughts and to drown out emotions, to drown out feelings. And it's not building us up. And the prescribed punishment for the glutton and for the drunkard is that they will be hungry and thirsty when judgment comes. Verse 13. But there's more to it than this. And this is where we get into the first therefore in verse 13 and 14. The first two groups are now addressed in the first therefore statement. This is going to finish out this morning, but think about this for a second. What do these two groups have in common? So you have the greedy and the debauched. What do they have in common?
Self-focused.
They're self-focused. It's more than that, though.
Never enough.
It's never enough. Okay, so what these sins have in common is that they are both excesses of the appetite. One is an appetite for wealth. Another is an appetite for food and drink and music. But they're both excesses of a natural desire. They're both excesses of the appetite. They're insatiable appetites for wealth and for wine. And as unquenchable as their appetites are, here's the judgment for this kind of sin. This, going back to our introduction, these are the thick sins, the sins of the belly and the eye. These are the sins of trying to feed and satisfy and gratify my flesh until there's no joy in the thing which used to bring me joy. What's the punishment for this? That someone is coming who is even more gnawing, more unending, more insatiable. Who? Sheol. Hell is coming. And hell here is, as one commentator puts it, imagined as a hungry dragon with her mouth opened beyond measure, swallowing up Jerusalem in death. That is insatiable as the lusts of men are. Death and hell and the grave are never satisfied. Now, I will just note, because we'll come back to this much later in the study, that the Canaanite personification of death was Mot, M-O-T, Mot. Mot was sort of the god of death, but more than that, he's the personification of the metaphysical reality of death. And Mot's thing is that when people take him off, and this is in the Baal cycle, and again, we'll do all of that when we get to it. But he swallows up, like, when people and things take him off, including Baal, he swallows them up. He just, what you gonna do? I'm death. What you gonna do? I'll tell you what God does. In Isaiah, and then later on, Paul quotes it in 1 Corinthians, death, which has been swallowing up all these things, death is swallowed up in victory. And I love that, because when Isaiah will say that, and when Paul quotes it, he's not just saying some nice metaphor for there's death and it's swallowed up in victory. He's saying, hey, you know that myth where Mot swallowed Baal? Let me tell you how sorry a god Baal is. He was swallowed up by death, but Yahweh has swallowed up death in victory. And I'm very excited about getting to that, so we'll do it when we do. And then he says, man is humbled. Death and judgment are the great equalizers. Judgment from a just God will not respect wealth. It will not respect persons. And so the fine vineyards, which the first group wants to own, and which the second group wants to enjoy, will become the places where the nomads come to graze their flocks. So it's a very poetic kind of justice. All right, we're straight out of time this morning. We did the thick sins today. We're going to do the clear sins next week, because it's really easy to be hard on people who are capable of being much more greedy than we are, because they have more money. And it's really easy to be hard on people who are drunkards or addicts. Next week, we're going to get to the church sins. And it's not to say, because you're not struggling with one of these, that you're not struggling with, and it's not to say that just because you're a church people doesn't mean you're not struggling with one of the sins we talked about this morning. Remember that what we want to try to do is look for ourselves and look for our sins in Judas, because the stroke, the swath that Isaiah cuts through their sins is both broad and deep. Are we living overmastered to our appetites and our hobbies? Have we placed so much delight in our pleasures that we're no longer able to see in them the work of God? Here's another question. Have you ever seriously tried to look for the work of God in your daily pleasures? Have you seriously tried to look for God in your food? Like, if we started thinking about God in relation to our food, how would that change the way that we eat? And I'm not just saying we'd cut back on the bacon grease. Because personally, the fat belongs to the Lord and my body is a temple, so put it all in. Now, I'm pretty sure that is a misuse of some scripture. But how would we, you know, we sit down to thank the Lord for our food, like before every meal. Like, we do that and we don't even think about what we're saying. I have my thank you, Lord, for this food, blessed food to our bodies, et cetera, so down pat that I don't even think about it when I'm saying it. Some of you may be the same way. But, I mean, think about the fact. God did not have to make food taste good. He could have made us really enjoy mulch, like cedar mulch from your garden. You could enjoy that. But instead, he gave us food. He gave us food and wine to gladden the hearts of men. He gave us coffee. He gave us bread. No, I'm serious, though. I mean, what an incredible thing. What an incredible thing. He gave us a cultured dairy products. He gave us kefir, or kefir, as you might call it. That stuff blows my mind. Do you know why? Because the only way to make kefir is with other kefir. Now, this very quickly gets problematic. If you go back far enough, where did the first kefir grains come from? I don't know. The Caucasus, which is where that culture originated from, that's the culture where the culture originated from, In the Caucasus, the legend, and this is since they converted to Islam, is that Allah gave the kefir grains to men. Well, I don't think that happened, but I do know that good food comes from God. And God gave mankind a way to keep their milk from spoiling long before we made the refrigerator. I mean, just think about these things. And just when you sit down for our feast, which is how we spell fast, when you sit down for our feast this afternoon here at the church, and we eat in this fellowship hall, and we have all this good food, which our wives and our mothers and even some of us gentlemen have prepared. Think about how incredible it is that we can enjoy food. Like, I'm dead serious now. I'm not joking. Think about how incredible it is that we can enjoy food. If we thought about trying to see the work of God, to see the beautiful thoughts of God in our food and in our music, how would it change the way that we enjoy those things? Not just that it would make us do them less, but it would make us maybe stop trying to confuse quantity with quality. Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you so much that you are a God who made the heavens, that you send rain upon the just and the unjust, that you are the God of corn and of wine, and that all of these thick things, all of these things which nourish and satisfy and please our physical bodies, that these are good things which you have made and which you want us to enjoy. Please forgive us for becoming so obsessed with the gift that we have lost the sight of the hand of the giver. Lord, help us to regain the habit of looking for you in these things. Help us to regain pleasure in you so that the thing, that the food and the drink and the and human love, that all these things can become beautiful and fulfilling again. In Jesus' name.